This is the Aftermarket Radio Network. Hey, Master Connector of Automotive Aftermarket Professionals, Carm Capriotto here. Hey, welcome to the Town Hall Academy, episode 217, as we take a trip down memory lane and what auto repair was like in the 90s. Hey, it's quite fitting this episode is being released on a Thursday because it is the quintessential hashtag throwback Thursday. Now, the big thing in 1996 was the era of OBD2 and the huge shift in technology. Change is never easy, and I know you know that, but it's always a necessity. Now, hear how my guests handle the changes and adapt it in order to move forward. We had just enough fun that the law would allow. Hey, grateful to Shop Marketing Pros and Shopware for sponsoring the Academy. You know, every piece of paper you touch adds up to seconds, minutes, and hours of your staff's time. Get paper out of your business and unlock your employees' potential with Shopware's digital management software. On the web at getshopware.com. Is your marketing company sharing the same vanilla social media posts for you that they do for every other shop? Well, that's not how Shop Marketing Pros does business. They believe each shop is unique with its own story, and I know you have one. Contact them today on the web at shopmarketingpros.com. Hey, don't miss one virtual shop tour. Be a fly on the wall. Check out what other shops are doing. Find the tours at aftermarketweekly.com. Hey, you can watch the video of this episode, which is really cool to watch it in action and see the old and the new pictures. Find also the key talking points at remarkableresults.biz/A217. And be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And we are talking the 90s, talking auto repair in the 90s. It's Carm Capriotto. I got a great, great panel. I can't wait to introduce you to them live. Of course, there's the picture we've been using in marketing. I have to say, I think age has done you guys pretty well, all except for Paul. He kind of cut his hair.
I turned that light off up above. It was shining on my head, so you couldn't see the shining.
Oh, thank you for doing that, because I was really wondering if you were in that Wayne's World TV show back then.
So could have been.
And I'm just going to start by saying the camera adds 10 pounds, and I've got like 10 cameras on me right now, right?
Oh, excellent. I'm going to use that in the future. With me is Ryan Koyman, Director of Training at Standard Motor Products. Keith Katz, Quality Service Center, York, Pennsylvania. Scott Palava from Lonsdale Auto Works in Lonsdale, Minnesota. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
And Paul Danner, educator, diagnostician, and YouTuber, Scanner Danner. Hey, man.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm good, man. Okay. I got some pictures. You know, I was kind of horsing around on Facebook a little bit, and some people sent me a few shots, and here are a few shots that came in. I don't know who doesn't know Jerry Holcomb. Out there in Kansas City, one of the founders of Vision, Jerry Holcomb on the left, and the Carlson family there with Jamie, Eric, and Megan. And I'm not sure who the younger daughter is. Of course, they've been on the show before. And Connor Tracy is the picture on the left with the gray hat. Thank you for sending that to me, Connor. Hey, guys, so much to talk about. I've done my research. You guys have done your research. Did you know that Seinfeld debuted in the 90s?
Never watched an episode of it until it was in syndication years later.
Okay. You know, Gen X, that was the gen that we were all talking about, Generation X. And who replaced Johnny Carson in the 90s?
Jay Leno.
Jay Leno, yeah.
Jay Leno. And here's the big thing. OBD2.
Game changer.
Scary. That thing is still there.
To me, I think this is like you put the ball on the tee and you set this thing up and you hit it long ball. Let's just cover your perspective on OBD2 as we start out.
I was fresh out of high school when OBD2 came about. I remember all the horror stories and you know what this is going to do to the industry. And around that same time here in Michigan, IM240 was in the discussion. I mean, they went as far as even building test facilities, which they ended up never opening. And so there are dynos sitting around and all kinds of test machines. And so that was really a turning point in our shop's life and really truly in my career, you know, because we had to take it to the next level. And as a young guy, kind of embracing technology at the time and looking to set myself apart from the other techs in the shop, you know, maybe I was dumb enough. I went, yeah, I'll do it. and started learning that type of stuff, and you know, kind of adopted that. There's nobody behind me to ask for help. The buck stops here, right? And so I had to really learn the technology and go with it. We bought a cast machine at that time, and it started doing all kinds of weird tests and stuff like that. Stuff I look at now, like, wow, relative cranking compression and vacuum testing, and this, there's a lot of cool stuff that was introduced as a result of this, what OBD2 was going to be.
Paul, for you and your cohorts, it was a scary thing, right?
It's funny the way new technologies come around in our field. And I see similarities today with the changeover from port injection to GDI. I saw it. And then I see the same thing with the, you know, self-driving cars and what's coming, electric cars, and everybody gets all worried and scared. And then you just find out that electricity is electricity and it all does the same thing. It just, you know, you're just applying what you already know in an unfamiliar area, and you become familiar with the area and it's the same stuff you've always been doing. That's in hindsight, but going into OBD2 for sure. I just remembered what Ryan said about all those. We had that here on the western side of, or in Pennsylvania too, where they were, you know, going to do centralized the IM240 and the dyno testing. There's a shop right down the road from my brother's in Bethel Park that was supposed to be one of those centers and never became. But there was a lot of change in the field with OBD2, and I think a lot of information that was there didn't need to be as scary as it was presented.
Paul, did that open up your opportunity, your career? When did it blossom?
It was actually before OBD2. So I started full-time. I went to Rosedale Tech, where I teach now, but I went there in 91 to 93. I graduated in 93, and I was in the field full-time in 93. So I was in the field before OBD2 even began in its infancy anyway. I guess there was a couple of hybrid 94, 95 model years that were out there with a 16-pin OBD connector, but they weren't fully OBD compliant. To be honest, it really didn't change anything other than, you know, getting random oxygen sensor codes that I wasn't used to looking at, because we only saw O2 failures when they were actually dead. So that was new. And then seeing a misfire, you know, seeing misfire counters on cars, especially early years that had no misfires, that was a little bit interesting. And then my favorite is EVAP leaks, you know, so it's really not. I hate them. I still do. But yeah.
Scott, the 90s for you, were you starting your shop? And give us a little this flavor of that.
Actually, for me, it was weird because I used to be in home construction and remodeling. So when I got in my construction accident in 93, I got hired as a oil changer and a tow truck driver in a shop. And I went, well, this isn't going to be a career. So I decided I was going to go to school. And so I was in school in 94 and 95. So that's when the stuff was really rolling out. So they were really pushing it to us. But it was interesting because the teachers at the time had no idea what they were teaching. This is kind of what you should expect, but we're not 100% positive. So be open-minded. So I was entering it as OBD1 was phasing out and OBD2 was coming in. Right away, I think I wasn't even done with VOTEC, and I bought my first scanner. I want to say it was an OTC.
Monitor 4000 or something like that.
4000E. Yeah. Oh, I thought I was on the king of the world with that thing.
Mine
I
could, too.
Opened up a whole new, you know, whole new world for me, and I learned a lot as it was rolling out. As the technology was improving, I was improving right along with it. Sometimes I think going back to OBD1 is, anytime we get that stuff, it's actually painful because I forget how it actually works. We were doing post office vehicles, the LLVs, in our shop here for a while. That's all OBD1. And it was even a challenge to find stuff that would operate that anymore. I had to keep my old Snap-on Modus just to do that. Diagnosing OBD1 to OBD2, I was like, it was a godsend to have more information than we ever had in the first round.
Keith, your interesting 90s transition to a shop owner?
A little scary because it was later in 90 when I went into business for myself. And first coming into, you know, talking about the OBD2, you know, I had already been out of tech school for almost 10 years at that point. And so I didn't have anybody to really teach me that stuff. I had to learn a lot of it on my own. So that was kind of a little bit of a scary time for me. And then getting into opening up my own shop, you know, you have to sit there and say, you know, what do I need? You know, I'm going to do this. You know, there's a lot going on, but Also, back in the 90s, when you open up your shop, and some of you others might know about this too, is it was no big deal. You hung up a sign, you said, here's Quality Service Center, I'm open for business, and off you went. And you just kind of rolled with the punches. So much different than how you do it today.
You know what? I love what he said. It was scary. What the hell's today all about?
I don't get scared by it. And here's the thing that for me, I was at my 20-year high school reunion, and I was sitting there at the table with one of my buddies that I hung out with in high school. They really didn't talk to him much after that. He became a nuclear submarine engineer. And I went, really? You could do that? And I realized at that point is we're all just people. And if he can do that, I could have done that. So anything that's rolling down the assembly line, somebody's got to be able to do it. So why can't it be us? We're all trainable.
That's really the aftermarket story, right, Scott? And we've found a way to adapt and overcome. You know, I mean, today here I'm working for Standard Motor Products. Standard was founded in 1919. That's when the aftermarket was really kind of evolving and being born at that time, right? And we've continued to adapt. All of us have with this, and those that are willing to, at least. And so, you know, you guys talked about that earlier with the technology shift of OBD2. I mean, the older techs I worked with, I learned a ton of great tricks from, you know, how to heat something up and shrink it and just different stuff like that. They said, no, I'm done. I'm not learning OBD2, but they went through electronic ignition, introduction to fuel injection. And so, you know, I think people continue to evolve with this, and you know, where there's a will, there's a way.
I had a customer come in just today. We had a Tesla on the lift getting a state inspection, and he kind of looked at me and he said, boy, that's a game changer, isn't it? You know, so you go from, you know, what we were doing in the 90s, all freaked out over OBD2, to now we're getting into electric vehicles. It's been a huge swing over the past 20, 30 years.
Why are some of us freaking out about EVs to come and the new technology and ADAS? Shouldn't it be something we open our arms to?
People are afraid of change. They don't want to go out of their comfort zone. It makes people nervous no matter what. Uh-huh. And it's not like you're going to be going, if you were working independent or working in a regular, you know, full service garage, and you jumped to the Tesla dealer and it was full immersion, I could see that being really scary because you're trying to make a living off of something you have no idea. But if you can slowly immerse yourself, put a toe in at first and pick up as things go along, I think it's a lot easier for people.
We've even going from carburetors to fuel injection. I can remember this goes back in the 80s when I opened up the hood and I saw my first fuel injection on a Cadillac. And I was like, oh, whoa, 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 you know. But once you learn, you're like, man, why don't we do this sooner? It's a whole lot easier than those carburetors.
Exactly.
If I have one more old timer come in and tell me that he wishes that something had a carburetor because they were easier to work on, I'm going to throw them outside.
Well, and I'm part of the generation of coming in the 90s. You know, I graduated high school in 94. I've never owned a carbureted vehicle. Now, I've had some dragsters and stuff like that. But, you know, my first vehicle is a 79 Chevy truck with a 5.7 diesel. You know, that's how much my parents loved me. I wasn't going to get into a trouble with that thing. You know, never having had to work on carbureted vehicles. Yeah, I remember a couple, you know, choke pull-offs and stuff like that coming in, or, you know, some of the canisters being flooded and, you know, flooding the vehicle out. But I never really had to work too much on carbureted vehicles. And thank goodness for that.
I'm fortunate. I do have a tech here that loves carburetors. He's actually younger than I am, but he grew up working on all small engines and steam engines, even with his grandpa. So he'll work on anything. But I said he's just a duck that way. But he's one of the few people that enjoys doing that.
And that's kind of a lost art, right, Scott?
Yeah, sorry, absolutely.
No, it's okay. No, you're absolutely right. But you're in the country, so you need to have a carb guy, right?
Well, we don't get a ton of them, but from time to time we might do three or four of them a year. I mean, we're in the country, but we're still. I mean, I was just in Minneapolis here an hour ago. I mean, I'm only 45 minutes from the heart of Minneapolis, so I don't think we've had a grain truck in my shop for 5 years. We're mostly just general auto repair.
Let's talk about the diagnostic equipment. I mean, someone mentioned a monitor 4000, right? What were we using back then? Let's start with Ryan.
Well, paper clips. I think I got my old GM key yet. We jumped to ALDL yet. It's in my pocket.
Why are you charging me so much to scan my vehicle when all you need is a paper clip? I remember hearing that one.
Counting the flash codes and like, yep. Wait, I blinked. What was it? Did I miss one there? So we start over with that. But I still actually have a pretty good museum in my barn here out back at home. Yeah, I've got my Tech 1A, a couple different versions of the monitor. You know, and that was cutting edge at that point. And like I said, that we had the old Master Tech, the Vtronics Master Tech. We were spoiled here in my region in the Great Lakes area by having probably one of the top Vtronics reps. And he actually had Master Tech clubs. And that was a difference maker for me. Like the first Tuesday of every month, we'd get together with a bunch of these different shops and we'd collaborate and talk about diagnostic stuff and do some hands-on type of stuff. So, you know, and we shared and kind of learned the value of having OE equipment at that point as, you know, started getting into the NGS and the Star Scanner and some of that type of stuff as we're getting through the late 90s and recognizing the benefits of having scan data at our fingertips. You know, the first time I could diagnose a Ford F-250 door switch with a scan tool, I'm like, phew, that was awesome. Those things all went bad. You're trying to figure out which one it was, right?
Ford's were the worst. One of the worst.
Didn't seem to have as much diagnostic equipment back then as we do now. I can remember a lot of times just checking things and fixing things with a voltmeter and a test light. And then as you get into the later 90s, man, if you didn't have, well, like you said, the paperclip was very good, but if you didn't have any kind of a scan tool so you could see data as you went along, you got lost quickly.
Well, I think we started getting spoiled by that, right, Keith? All of a sudden you work in a GM with misfire counters or like, was it fuel trim, like numerative and adaptive, you know, the block learn and all that kind of stuff. And then you plug into a Ford and you have no misfire counters and you can't even get map data out of the thing. It's like, oh my goodness.
Was there frustration there, Ryan? Is that why you needed to get together with guys to try to compare notes?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think learn, what am I missing here? And that was really kind of the IETN or the diagnostic network of the day, right? You'd get together at classes or get together in these Master Tech clubs, as we call them, with guys throughout your region and just share notes and like, oh, well, I did this or I do this and go, okay, maybe I do need to buy a 5-gas analyzer at this point or there is an easier way of doing it. Whereas now with online chat rooms and you know, different type of stuff, even you know, this, right? We're sharing ideas that other people might not have thought about. So that was key.
You know, Paul, you were telling me that old technology still applies today. Can you explain that one to me?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we're seeing that unfold in front of us, you know, when it comes to troubleshooting. I think, like I said earlier, you learn a principle on something older and maybe that particular system doesn't exist anymore. But then what you learned back then directly applies. Like one example would be, say, a peak and hold fuel injector on an old TBI system where, you know, for a long time, you know, I even questioned, you know, should I even cover this anymore with my students? And then, you know, GDI comes around and they use a peak and hold style injector and it's perfect. Like you look at the waveform and when you compare the two together, it almost looks identical to some of these TBI peak and hold injectors. And so it's just an example of what's old is new. And, you know, I think there's a misconception sometimes that when you're learning something, like it has to be on within a 3-year window of a brand new car, you know, and I just think that that's wrong. I think there's so much that can be learned through all generations of computer controls that applies to today's cars. It's a foundational, you know, principles that can be applied. And when we see something new, we all adapt it differently. As some of you mentioned already, you know, we can take it as it comes and we learn and adapt. And that's exactly what we do. That's, you know, after doing this for 30 years now, that's what I'm seeing is adaptability and using what you've learned on older systems to apply to exactly what you're seeing right now.
Well, kind of like I brought up there with in 95, we bought this CAS machine before IM240, and that would do these automated tests. And you'd enter in the vehicle information, and then it would tell you to hook up this this clamp on the battery cable, tee into the vacuum, put the sniffer in the tailpipe, and do these systems of tests, and it would give you a printed report. I had no clue what that meant other than, I should sell a test, a tune-up or something. Yeah. But then, fast forward to the mid-2000s when I got like my first Pico scope and, started doing in-cylinder pressures and relative cranking compression and intake vacuum pulses. All of a sudden, to your point, Paul, I went, holy crap, I was doing this 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Like, I just didn't know. That machine was doing, right? What did you call it, Ron? A cast? It was a cast.
CAS. Yep.
When I worked for Pet Boys, we had a Sun machine that was programmed. Each Pet Boys would had the same one. And we were doing the same thing. It was telling me to do the exact same thing. And it gave me a printout and a result. And that was like 96. I had no idea. And then I sit in John Thornton's class in like 2002. And like you, first Pico scope. And I'm like, oh, that's what that machine was. Why didn't I do that cranking test more often? Because I never trusted it. When it was like telling me, oh, you have low compression on this cylinder. I'm like, how the heck does he know that? So, yeah.
There was a time where we would do a lot of things because we were told to do it, but we didn't understand why we were doing it. I think that's part of what happened, why education was turned off by so many. So many guys didn't want to go to tech school because, I know how to turn wrenches. What are you going to teach me that I don't already know? Well, all they were teaching was processes, not the reasoning behind it. I think that would have played a big problem of it.
Yeah, and we still see that in training today. I'll get a salesperson go, in one of your classes, you had this case study with a 2002 Ford Taurus. I go, time out. If you're looking for bullet points on 2018 and newer vehicles, we're not your training company. We're trying to teach theory and operation. And to Paul's earlier point, I still think we could use a Model T to teach the four strokes of combustion, right? And if somebody understands that theory, that's what we're trying to train on. It's not the latest, greatest 2020 model of, Hyundai or Kia or whatever. By teaching true theory, as you mentioned there, Scott, that enables a person to think and to start learning more on their own.
Hey, Carm here. And coming up, in what ways did the automotive customer of the 90s change from then to now? You'll find out. I want to let you in on a little secret. Investing in a cloud-based shop management system could be the smartest purchase you make in 2021. Manual processes can really add up and cost your shop unnecessary time and money. Now, if you're writing out repair orders, you're wasting time. If you're chasing customers for approvals, you're wasting time. If you're manually calculating invoices or logging into multiple systems, you're wasting time. And if you're wasting time, well, then you're wasting money. Do me a favor, pull up Chrome, Safari, or whatever browser you use and type in getshopware.com. Click on the Book a Demo button in the upper right corner and check out Shopware's amazingly efficient software. Trust me, you won't regret it. That's getshopware.com. Hey, Carm here. Have you heard this before? If you need something, we're just a phone call away. But then when you need something and you make that phone call, nothing. Well, if you needed something from your marketing company right now, today, could you get their help? Or now that they've got your money, has the personalized attention just faded away? Well, we've all experienced something like this. If you want that to go away, I want to introduce you to my friends over at Shop Marketing Pros. Shop Marketing Pros is a boutique marketing company. Now, what that means is they're small. It also means that they know their clients because they communicate with them regularly. If you're tired of working with a big transactional agency who treats you just like another auto repair shop, well, it's time to talk to the folks over at Shop Marketing Pros. They are a real phone call away. Find them on the web at shopmarketingpros.com. What's so interesting about looking at our industry from the 1990s to where we are today is, Ryan's talking about working in a shop. And the evolution of Ryan is the director of training at Standard Motor Products. So what wonderful opportunities that we've all had to make for each other. Scott, Keith, their own companies, and Paul, Scanner Danner, education teacher to, a YouTube phenom, and for all the great things that you guys do. What I'd like to know, is the customer changed at all?
No.
Yes and no. They're still the same, but the one thing that's really different, and I know all you that own shops are going to agree with this, is I can get that part online. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the 90s, you didn't hear that at all. I mean, you never heard that, but, you know, everyone still wants it done for next to nothing, and I miss those days of I can get that part online.
I have a couple case studies to help you guys out, and I can, when we're done here, I can share a link with you. So, you know, one in particular is a Hyundai with a purge valve that absolutely needed to be a factory part made by Bosch. We went to 3 different aftermarket companies to get one, and every single one of them failed EVAP leak. It would be a good video to show your customer. So there's enough. I think people are starting to learn. On your point, you're right. That is different, where people are shopping prices, but people are also learning that a lot of these parts are junk. I've seen more junk parts now than I've ever seen in my whole life.
I totally respect what Paul is saying, but Scott, I'd like you to chime in, and then Ryan, you may have a chance for a rebuttal.
One of the things too is, and not just the not just I found it on the internet, but now there are chat rooms or forums. There's YouTube. You know, there's all these things. People have told for years. Been told for years they need to educate themselves so they better understand what's happening with their cars, and that's what they've done. But unfortunately, there's a lot of garbage out there, or they're cherry picking what they're going after. So they come in thinking that they're well versed in what's happening, and they have no clue. The other thing is now with
I'm not helping that sometimes.
God. No, and then they can buy their own code scanner, and they think they've got it all figured out because I know the code. What's it going to take to fix it? Part of that is just because you know it, you know the code, doesn't tell you what's wrong. And, well, you know, why did you charge me to scan my car? All you had to do was put a paperclip in there. You know, it comes back to that. There's this expectation that the code is going to give us everything, and now that I've got a code reader and the internet, I don't need that. I don't need to pay for that. The internet is necessary evil, I guess.
It's a dual-edged sword.
Blessing and a curse, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I left the shop in 2010, Scott, it was that exact same thing, except it's exasperated many times mm-hmm. over now. But I'll still never forget it. At that time, customer brings his truck in, the check engine light on, and now he needs us to drill out some broken-off bolts in the intake manifold when he was trying to replace his own EGR valve. Well, he already replaced the EGV. He already cleaned out the passages because he read something online about that. At the end of the day, it was a broken vacuum hose. So if he would have paid me a diagnostic fee, I would have probably fixed the vacuum hose for free, right? But instead, he threw a bunch of parts at it, broke off bolts, did a lot of stuff. You know, and fast forward to the other day. I mean, the joke is I'm Sasquatch around my hometown. Not because I'm just big and hairy, but because there's often evidence I've been somewhere, but nobody's ever seen me. So I'll get into some of these shops at night. I still have access to keys to some of them and sniffing around. But my old shop the other day replaced the HID bulb and ballast on a customer's car. But if you've done those, you have to cut off and pull the front fascia off. And it's a couple hours worth of work. Well, they brought their own online cheap as possible part to it. Said, here, install this. Shop said, okay, we're going to charge more per labor. No warranty, you know, the whole nine yards. Eventually, he said, okay, we'll do it. Well, they get it apart, and it's the wrong part. And I'll call the customer up and like, okay, you can install the part that we're going to source, and we're going to warranty and do this, or we'll reassemble the car for you and charge you the labor all over again. And that customer is a very expensive lesson, right?
Some people will spend thousands to save hundreds. Or exactly. To, you know, or spend $1,000 and right. Really only need to spend $100.
Yeah. And yep. Now my rebuttal back on the parts side here is an aftermarket manufacturer. we've actually just kicked off this big What's in Your Box campaign, exactly to what Paul was saying, though. Quite often with some of these other people, you don't know really what's in their box, you know, and that's where it is fun as a manufacturer here. And I'm actually involved with engineering and running our vehicle test facility here to understand, you know, with our product, we engineer it, we test it, we validate it. We have vehicles that we test the stuff on. And then, you know, we don't expect our customers to do the validation for us to go back in our box. So we do know what's in the box. Are we perfect? No, not always. But, you know, a lot further, you hear the old story of a friend of mine that's a shop owner said, yeah, I tried installing an 8-pack of coils that a customer bought online, no name, you know, overseas. it took him the whole 8-pack of coils to find one that would actually work properly in the customer's vehicle. And he said, you know, when I buy a no-name brand, I can trust it the first time.
I'm not trying to stick up for my friend Ryan, but I remember being in Long Island City, I think, and having spending a day at Standard, you know, in my old career, and then watching how the parts are engineered. And then what I thought was fascinating was the jigs that were built to test the parts after they got created, and, you know, to test movement or vacuum or whatever it was. And I was fascinated to see the kind of work that went into the testing process once the part was built. And I guess it's a huge QC thing that you guys got going there.
We actually just put together a YouTube video on that. Actually, you can find it at our Standard Brand channel of walk through our engineering lab. Carm, as you've had that opportunity back in the day, everybody leaves that lab and goes, holy cow, I didn't know. And so we actually put together a tour of that.
Let's talk about the kind of service information, or everyone, this kind of service information you guys had to steer you into a correct repair.
I was actually talking to one of my techs about it this morning too, because I told him we were doing the show. And when I think it was All Data came out on discs, I was adamantly opposed to it over and over. Books don't crash, because that's all I knew. We weren't going to have problems. The books are always there. The wiring, you know, books don't crash. I don't want to do the electronic stuff. We had one terminal set up. So if you had two guys looking for something, you had to wait for the other guy at the terminal. And you know, at least you could have, you know, you could have two different books going at the same time. I was so opposed to it. But, now I, you know, probably one of the best things we've ever done is going to electronic, because the stuff can be updated. You're getting real time things. I mean, TSBs, they were unheard of in the aftermarket. You'd chase your tail for 3 days trying to find something, and then it would turn out that a TSB addressed it, and you would have found it in 10 minutes.
I spent the early part of the 90s working for someone else, and he had a hard time even spending the money to buy the books. We had books were scarce, but then, like you mentioned, they came out with it on disc, and I was like, man, we need to get this. We need to get this. We need to get this. It's probably the first thing I ordered when I decided I was going out on my own. I'm like, this is ridiculous. So I fully embraced the disc, unlike you. I was just, and part of this didn't have a good source of books just because my boss, can I say it was too cheap to buy them? But anyway, but I tell you what, the disc, and I remember, you know, you had one disc for GM, one for Ford, one for Chrysler, and like four for import, you know, it was crazy. But, and then when it went online, I was like, yeah, get these discs going online. It's phenomenal. So yeah, fully embrace that. No problem there.
Anybody remember when it all went online? What year was that?
Early 2000s.
The internet was in full blossom in the late 90s, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't what it is today, but I think everybody was embracing it. Or was it the dial-up modems back then, too?
You had to insert your disk to get your Microsoft up, you know, up and working. But
wait a minute. I got to read this comment from Buckley. Oh, God, Greg, that is awesome. Nightmares at noon, because that's what I'm reliving right now. That is so funny. You know, guys, we did the 70s and we did the 80s, and it seems like they were more light and livelier. It was not that this isn't a lot of fun, but it just seemed like the 70s and 80s. This one is closer to our world today, and there was so much transition going on. And I guess to Greg's point, oh, my God, I can't believe we were fixing cars like we were with all that new tech coming out. You know, especially in the late 90s, in 96 when OBD2 came on board. And, of course, the handy paper clip was on everyone's keychain.
That was a quarter century ago, too, you know, the 90s. It wasn't like it was yesterday.
Thanks for that reminder. You know?
Going back a little bit to the online stuff, because I remember when I left the shop I was working at, we were handwriting everything. All our invoices were handwritten. And they had programs out already that you could put for the automotive industry. And my boss was like, no, we're going to handwrite everything. You know, again, when I went to electronic, putting it in through, oh my gosh, it was just like, I know some shops that still handwrite tickets, and I'm like, I can't believe it. Oh, my goodness.
I get involved with our warranty processes and labor claims, and it's amazing. I mean, I did a case study for Bernie Thompson in the early 2000s with his scan tool of doing screen capture and emailing it to the customer at that time to go, this is why I'm saying you need a catalytic converter. And then you also have the original tune-up components. With digital camera, we can send that stuff. Now you do it through all sorts of technology. But right. Yet today, I still get somebody turning in an engine claim, and asking for a boatload of money with a handwritten invoice. Part was bad. Like, come on. Yes, absolutely. I feel blessed to have grown up in the 90s. And as Keith was saying, that transition from handwritten invoices to all of a sudden now getting electronic stuff and being able to look up customer history and canned jobs. I remember that was becoming a new thing and, some of that stuff. And like, wow, did that change? In the shop I work at, we did oil changes, tires, full engine repair, but we had a car wash there as well. And so all of us guys were kind of randomly scrolling around and doing every task. And then kind of around mid-90s with computerization and shop management type stuff, then we all started, okay, you're a technician. You got to keep fixing cars. And we're measuring your efficiency in the bay at that time instead of running to get a car wash. And that was a real industry changer, I feel, around that time.
I'm sorry to change the subject, but I didn't realize that Standard Motor Products, that you guys manufacture parts too. So here's me knocking the aftermarket. No. But listen, I want to say something. I know you guys at Standard Motor Products. I know Jim Wilson very well. Yep. And there is not a sharper mind in the field. And so props to Standard Motor Products as far as what you guys are doing. Seriously, I mean that.
Yeah,
the heart. Yeah. Like, is there something that you could tell us? I was just looking on the website. It looks like maybe I recognize having a part that says Standard Motor Products on the box, but is there another label that it would be listed under SMP?
So Standard brand, in Blue Streak back in the day, a lot of the people recognize Blue Streak as kind of a step above problem solving solution there. So Standard brand is our flagship brand, but also Napa Eklund is SMP product as well. So, Four Seasons, Temperature Control, Napa Temp. We've got like 18 different brands under us here. So, it is an honor to be part of a 100-plus-year company run still the fourth generation. To be over a $1 billion company, the fourth generation CEO is still, part of the family. And they hold those values. And understanding training is an important part of the value add here, right? And so, we train over 70,000 technicians a year to help keep the aftermarket alive.
It's awesome. I got to be careful. Like, you can't just make a blanket statement like I did. Like, all aftermarket parts suck. They don't. It's just, we just have this in a really awful time right now as far as getting quality parts. And
we recognize that.
I mean, so.
Okay, guys, final segment here. What didn't we cover that we want to talk about this wonderful decade of the 90s that you guys were part of?
One of the things I really miss was the repeated constant failures on certain cars that we could do over and over. A Chrysler 2225 pickup coils. I mean, you can do two or three of them a day.
Or head gaskets on that same engine, right?
Yeah, head gaskets, timing belts, that kind of stuff. I was making so much money as a tech. Yeah. I 1 week I could make my house payment and my truck payment, and I had 3 weeks of fun money the rest of the month. Yeah, I really miss those days.
No, we did a ton of tune-ups. I mean, GM fuel pumps, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so that's where I dropped out of college, at that point, because I was making more money than my parents were, still working part-time as a tech afterwards and kind of getting into the flat rate groove. And, there were just great money to be made on that type of stuff. And, there was the pattern failure type stuff. And a lot of tune-ups, cap rotor, plugs, wires, do an injector flush while you're at it. Maybe a transmission flush, not quite to the wallet flushing stage, but that was all new stuff at that time, and it was easy to make money.
That was kind of the beginning of the upsell era. You were getting so much work done during the day, it was easy enough to get to sell something else on top of it and still get it all done in the allotted time. It was the book time for doing the one job. You got four or five things done.
Even the ease in doing some of those jobs, I think of the escorts with the timing belts. I mean, like you said, you'd see two or three of them a week, it seemed like. And the guy I was working with at the time, we had a competition to see who could do it the fastest. I did it in 21 minutes. He beat me by 19 minutes. He did it 19 minutes. I was like, yeah, that was a lot easier, but you're not going to do that on a... I don't know, Toyota Camry now with the timing belt, you know, V6, you're not going to do that in 20 minutes. I wish you could, but, you know, everything was so much easier.
Guys, what were the labor rates back then?
Not enough. same as now, not enough.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to remember. I want to say in the late 90s, I want to say we were in the like $90 an hour, and I was in a suburb of St. Paul.
There are some out there that charge 90 now.
September 11th really kind of changed our market. It really kind of kicked everybody down with the cash for clunkers and all that stuff. And then the 2000s became survival mode. And then everybody's afraid to charge more. Not everybody. There's many people that are afraid to charge more. But I remember that because, you know, at that time I was making $32 an hour flat rate. And that was a third of the labor.
The shop I was working for when I left in, what year did I leave? I left in 98. The shop I was working for was $35 an hour.
But when that's why you couldn't afford books.
Well, yeah. when I was right. I opened up, and I mean, I'm not bragging about it, but I was 45. I mean, right off the bat, I saw that there. But it was just me. It was a one man show. You could do it a little bit cheaper, but once you started building, you know, your business and employees and everything, all that had to change. But yeah, 45 when I opened up. 98.
Paul, do you remember the rates where you were working?
I'm trying to remember. I was thinking the shop I started working for that my brother now owns, I got to say they were in the $60 to $70 an hour range maybe when I started there in 93. I'm pretty sure somewhere in that range.
I was going to guess about 50 here in West Michigan. Yeah.
So interesting, guys. This was a blast. I'll go around the room. Any final comments here about the 90s? Ryan Coyman, Director of Training, Standard Motor Products. Scott Palava was with us from Lonsdale Auto Works in Lonsdale, Michigan. Paul Danner, educator, diagnostician, and YouTuber, Scanner Danner. And Keith Katz from Quality Automotive in York, PA. Ryan, any final thoughts on the 90s?
It's been a great ride. I'm thankful that I had those opportunities back in the day, you know, because I appreciate what we have today, you know, working smarter, not harder on some of the stuff. I mean, I remember a little bit like an old Delta 88 or something, or where you had to replace a water pump. You had to pull off like 16 different brackets, right, to get the AC compressor and the, you know, and you're adjusting 30 different V-belts and stuff like that. Good grief, you know.
Yeah, I don't miss that.
Glad they don't make them the way they used to.
Thankfully, right? And so I have a new appreciation for today's technology and having evolved through that and seeing how beneficial it's been and how exciting it's been. I mean, I embrace the technology with that promise that someday the diagnostic tech is going to get paid what he's worth. I still don't think we've reached that yet, but as technology continues to evolve, I think there's more and more possibility to reward those top technicians that do dedicate their life really to this type of stuff. So it's exciting.
Great summary. Thank you so much, Paul.
Love and hate. Let's see. I don't miss feedback carburetors, especially the early Honda ones with like 50,000 vacuum lines. For whatever reason, the manufacturers love to use computer controlled vacuum solenoids. I don't know. Why don't you just make it a computer controlled solenoid? And, you know, I don't know. Anyway, don't miss that. Technology is the same as far as, you know, understanding duty cycle and pulse width. I learned that on a feedback carburetor. I'm still using that today on today's car. So just to make my point there. And one final thing would be, I definitely miss my hair. I would grow it again like my son. If I could, I would definitely do that. And then everyone can tell me, get a haircut, you hippie. You're not going to amount to anything. They can keep saying that. I'm good with that. You don't know how much crap I got from people for that. I mean, people looking down on me. And you know, I would totally grow it back again just to stick it to them.
Get a wig, baby. Come on. You should have come on here with a wig. That would have been so cool. Yeah, that was a cool picture. Thank guys for sending us that picture of this unbelievable contrast with this group. We'll put that up right at the end again. Thank you for that, Paul. Keith?
There's so much that I miss. I shouldn't say so much. There's a lot that I do miss, but I'm glad that we've progressed as far as the automobile, as far as how we do things. You know, getting out of the shop and opening my own place so that I had the freedom to do these things, even down now to digital inspections where I see a lot of other shops that just don't do any of that. But the one thing that I do really, really miss is the access to a lot of technicians. You know, we all talk about the technician shortage and all. And, you know, back in the day, if you needed somebody, you put an ad out and there were 20 people knocking at your door. So it was a whole lot easier to find technicians. And unlike Paul, I still got my hair.
It looks good.
It might be a different color, but it's kind of funny too, Carmen, that picture that you show there. My son is actually sitting on my lap there, and he's now in his 30s. So it's just like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? We're all getting old, but thanks for doing this, Carmen. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for being here. We had this obvious question coming from social media. What is the shop rate now in the U.S.? And that would be a very difficult question from West Coast to East Coast, from North to South. It is so variable. Let's just say that it's anywhere between 90 and 175 as an average. I don't know, guys. I'm just playing around. I may be right. I may be wrong. But social media sites will tell you. But then don't set your sights based on what the guy down the road is doing. Really know what your cost of doing business is before you do that. And that's just my little soapbox moment for right now. Hey, Scott, I'll let you clean it up.
Like we were talking about, we saw a lot of pattern failures. There was a lot of transitions that took place. So carburetor to fuel injection, coil on plug, or distributorless ignition. The 90s really was a huge turning point from rear wheel drive to front wheel drive. There was a ton of changes that took place, and it was a learning experience for many people. And I view the 90s as the time, as the kind of the second generation of automobiles. It went from being machinery to being computer controlled devices. And then everything after that is just constant improvement.
This was a blast. Thank you all so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.